Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, February 1st, 2012. This is a Senate Resources Committee. We have here today, beginning at my far right, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, beginning at my far left, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, and co-chair Senator Wagner, myself, Senator Pascven. We're expect to be joined soon, we hope, by Senator McGuire, but we see Senator Geisel in the audience. But anyway, welcome to all. Today, the Senate Resources Committee welcomes Dr. Shelby Gerking to present research that he has participated in that appears in Chapter 9 of this book, which is called U.S. Energy Tax Policy. And there are a number of chapters in this book that deal with the oil industry in Alaska and aspects of taxation that deal with that. Chapter 9 in this book is co-authored by Dr. Gerking, and it's titled State Tax Policy and Oil Production, The Role of the Severance Tax and Credits for Drilling Expenses. This book, which is published by Cambridge University Press, was published in 2011. And then also, and I believe that these are in the Senator's packets, there's two other research papers that have been authored or co-authored by Dr. Gerking. Titled The Effective Tax Rates on Oil and Gas Production, a 10-state comparison, and that is, and we are joined with us by Senator McGuire. Welcome. Anyway, it's a this 2005 study was called a 10-state comparison. The other research paper that is called a State Taxation, Exploration, and Production in the U.S. Oil Industry, and that is dated 2001. As Dr. Gerking notes in his research, quote, Alaska has increased the severance tax on the value of its oil production and attempted to stimulate future production by allowing a credit against this tax for expenditures on capital items, including drilling rigs, infrastructure, exploration, and facility expansion, close quote. And while Alaska has not been the sole focus of Dr. Gerking's research, he has tracked the changes in Alaska's tax policy over the past decade. His research on state tax policy and oil production is obviously relevant to the important issues before this committee and indeed relevant to the state of Alaska. I am pleased that he is joining us via teleconference from the Sunshine State, and we welcome you, Dr. Gerking, and thank you for participating in this legislative hearing. Dr. Gerking. We are in the middle of a hopefully minor technical difficulty. Why don't we take a brief at ease while Madam Technician, brief at ease. All right, Dr. Gerking, we're performing a quick check, Dr. Gerking. Do we have any connection with Florida at the moment?
Anybody out there in Orange Country? Happens every time.
Dr. Gerking? We cannot hear you. We're hoping that there's a connection and we just need to improve it.
We just need a professor.
Okay.
I'm hoping the connection can be improved.
All right, Dr. Gerking, I believe we do have full contact now. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, perfect. It appears that we do have a teleconference established, so very much I do thank you for participating in this process and providing your insights into this issue that's facing the state of Alaska. So welcome, Dr. Gerking.
Thank you, Senator. I hope I can help you.
All right. To begin with, would you please identify yourself for the record and tell the Senate Resources Committee your educational background, your professional work experience, and then briefly get into the types of research and experience regarding state tax policy and oil production.
Yes, sir. I was born in Indiana. I have my PhD in economics from Indiana University in 1975. I've worked at Arizona State University on a full-time basis at Indiana, at Wyoming, and I've been at University of Central Florida for the past 11 years, and I currently have a professorship at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. I've worked with aspects of state of energy tax policy for the past 30 years or so. My first experience with this was a study that I did with two co-authors for the state of Kansas in 1982 or 1983. I can't remember the date. It's too long ago. And then most of the time that I spent working in this area was in the state of Wyoming. And I think one of the papers that you referenced a moment ago, dated 2001, is largely about the tax situation in Wyoming, and I did a major study for that state in 1999 to 2000. I've also did another study in the state of Utah in addition to the one dated 2005 that you mentioned, and I've also participated in deliberations on severance tax policy on a less formal basis in California, Pennsylvania, Alberta, and I think that's the extent of it. And then that culminated in this paper written for the American Tax Policy Institute, and the paper was presented in Washington in 2009, and published last year in 2011. So that's maybe that gives you a little bit of information about my background, sir.
Sure. If you could just briefly explain what that U.S. Tax Policy Institute's function is or what its purpose is.
Mainly to hold conferences. they don't really have a legislative agenda that I know of. The Tax Policy Institute is funded by. It's just funded by private gifts, and the idea I think has been just to have some conferences to vet issues on particularly energy tax policy as they affect as it comes from primarily the federal government and to an extent state government.
And as I understand your comment regarding your is it a neutral group? In other words, it's not taking
it is a neutral group.
Yeah, so it's not appearing to participate for or against any particular issue. The tax policy group is neutral in that regard.
Sir, so far as I know, they're neutral.
Okay. All right, thank you. And regarding the state legislatures, have you appeared before other state legislatures to provide opinions or thoughts regarding tax policies in America relating to the oil industry.
Senator Fastman, I've appeared a number of times in Wyoming, also once in Kansas and another time in Utah.
Thank you. And Dr. Gerking, if you could begin your presentation, and we have from my staff, Kimberly Van Wy, that we have a PowerPoint presentation that is up on the screen so that the viewing audience can hopefully follow and see. Hopefully we can stay in sync. So at your discretion, please begin.
Yes, sir. I think that you can help me a little bit in that because I cannot see you, I can't tell whether members of the committee would like to ask questions or stop me to get a point of clarification. And so I would hope that you could act on their behalf and stop me for questions if they if I'm going too fast, can't be heard, need to clarify issues and so forth. So with that, I'll start, and I'm going to speak from the slide that's titled Introduction here. The way I got into this tax policy area was in Kansas, where we were asked what seemed to be a simple question: how do you compare severance tax rates between states? And at the time, I was not really aware of how different the tax bases were to which severance taxes are applied. There are differences. Some states tax levy a severance tax against the value of oil production at the wellhead. Other states levy the same tax against the value of production at the well foot. Each state has a different set of exemptions and credits. Sometimes, I think like in Alaska, the severance tax rate depends on the price of oil, and some states levy local property taxes, which work just like severance taxes. Wyoming is an example of that. So if you, so there's more to the story of comparing taxes between states than just taking the nominal or what you might call the legislated severance tax rates that appear in the statutes, and just comparing the numbers, because that amounts to a real apples and oranges comparison. Instead, if you're going to make these comparisons, it's good to calculate what I would call effective tax rate. In other words, put all the tax rates on a common basis by taking severance tax dollars collected and dividing by the value of production, where you can get the value of oil production on a common basis by using the price series available from the American Petroleum Institute. Those are prices by states over time, and multiplying that by quantity of oil produced, and that's available for DOE. So when I talk about tax rates, I'm going to be referring to effective tax rates, such as those that appear on the, I believe, on the next slide, and that's with that would have a table 9-1 entitled Oil Production and Tax Rates for Selected U.S. States.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Gerking. If I could interrupt for 1 minute, I would like the record to reflect that we have Deputy Commissioner Tangeman here, so welcome to the committee. I don't see the commissioner back there. But anyway, I just wanted to let the record reflect that we have Department of Revenue Deputy Commissioner Tangeman here. So, Dr. Gerking, we do have Table 9.1 on the screen in front of us and in the handout, so we are tracking with you on that.
Okay, glad we're doing okay so far. The table, we don't need to go over this in any particular detail, but the one of the points that you can easily get from the table is that the effective tax rate column the numbers or the percentages there are lower than the nominal rates, and this is because, as I mentioned earlier, states grant sometimes credits and exemptions against the tax, the seventh tax. And so the effective tax rate nets those out, while the nominal rate would not do that, and that's one of the main reasons why the effective rate column percentages are lower than the nominal rate that you see there. And then I also list the corporate income tax rates for each state, and those are nominal rates. Perhaps we'll come back to those later. So if we could go to the next slide, we'll try to move through this a little bit. So the next slide asks sort of the question of the day, I guess, and that's what is the effect of a change in the severance tax rate or a change in incentives to find new reserves? We're going to be interested in looking at the effect of those changes on oil production in a state, drilling activity in a state, and severance tax collections in a state. And there are two ways you could do a study to get those questions. One is you could do a statistical study using observational data for one state or many states, but it turns out the data are not really good enough to support the kind of statistical study that I would like to do. In fact, I tried to do this once for Wyoming and ended up giving up because the model just wasn't sufficient to make an accurate prediction of what would happen if the tax rates were changed. So instead of doing it that way, we instead use a simulation model. And the simulation model, I want to avoid the technical details and just give you a little history and talk about what it does. Based on some work by Harold Cotelli in 1931, and that was followed up by some work by Robert Pindyke in 1978. I can say that the model has stood the test of time. There's not very much economics from the 30s that's used anymore. And additionally, this is not a model that is based on any particular ideology or any particular political philosophy. That is just a model to try to represent how, in a simple way, profits in the oil industry could be maximized over time. And so if you're going to talk about profit maximization, you have to talk about revenues. And so we need to focus this model on revenues earned from production from existing reserves, as well as exploration for new reserves. In other words, you can produce today from existing reserves, but you have to explore today to find new reserves from which you can produce tomorrow and tomorrow after that. And the model also, just like it treats revenues, it also treats costs. And the kinds of costs that are particularly relevant here would be drilling costs and operating costs, or what we might call lifting costs. So that's a thumbnail description of the model, and if you go to the next slide, please, the couple simulation model continues. It has a couple of key features that should not escape notice.
Dr. Gerking, if you could hold off for 1 minute, it may be that we're going to have to establish a better connection. Dr. Gerking, could you, what the technical people are saying is that to establish or hopefully a better connection, if you could hang up and redial so that we hopefully get a better Florida to Alaska connection. We're getting enough volume, but there's some significant static that's coming with that.
All right, I'll call back.
at ease. Light on and see how the connection is. Dr. Gerking, hopefully we have a better connection.
Okay. Yes, sir.
All right. I believe we have a much better connection now. So if you would just hold on, we are not on the record yet. We will assemble everyone. I think they went to get a glass of soda or cookie or something. So if you would just give us a moment. Like Gerking, not right now, but if you could just kind of backtrack a little bit and summarize the stimulation model a little bit more so that we make sure that that's we're all up to speed.
Begin now, sir?
Sure, we can we'll go back on the record and we can get started. You may yes, you may proceed. please proceed.
Sorry, sir. The simulation model is the ideas for it are old. They took the test of time. They don't represent any particular ideology or political philosophy. The model describes profit maximization in the oil business in a simple way over time. It's an abstract model. And it basically, so if it's going to look at profit maximization, it's going to look at the difference between revenues and costs. Hopefully revenues are going to be larger than costs, so that difference would be positive. There are two key features of the model that are worth explaining about a little. One is that the cost, the model compares the cost of drilling and the cost of operating a well to the amount of oil that's produced. Okay, so it's not simply a matter of, so the model draws attention to the fact that it's not simply a matter of comparing cost of drilling or production, if you will, between states. You need to compare cost to amounts produced. In other words, you can have production in a high-cost area if there's a correspondingly high payoff. I think the highest cost, one of the highest-cost areas around the continental U.S. that I'm aware of would be in the Gulf of Mexico. It's pretty expensive to operate in the Gulf of Mexico. High-cost area, but the payoff is high. So that's why you can... So that's why we observe operation there. On the other hand, I think it's still probably true that Kansas would be an example of a state where costs are lower than perhaps. and also, but there's still production, and we still have production, even though payoffs from what, you know, oil production are comparatively smaller than they might be in Alaska or in the Gulf of Mexico or in another state in the U.S. So it's critical to compare cost to the amount produced. It's less important, maybe not important, to be just comparing straight cost between states. The second feature of the model that I want to talk about is it accounts for interaction between state and federal tax collections. What on earth might that mean? It really refers to the fact that the severance tax is a deductible item against federal corporate income tax liabilities. This may sound like a lecture from the Internal Revenue Service, but it's an important point, because if you increase the severance tax on oil in Alaska, that's going to create a larger deduction for oil companies against the federal corporate income on their federal corporate income tax side, and will lower their federal corporate income tax payments. So when you raise taxes, it's like you're getting a portion of the proceeds to tax indirectly from the federal government. On the other hand, when you reduce the severance tax, that's going to increase federal corporate income tax payments, and so that's going to take some of the revenue that you could have had from the severance tax and hand it over to the federal treasury indirectly. So the way the model works is it uses data on production costs, proven reserves, federal and state corporate tax rates, et cetera, a lot of other data, and uses a discount rate of 4%. Remember, we have to have a way to get production and the value of production from a future year back to the present, so we can make some of the comparisons that will be needed later. So the model works over time, and so we have to have some concept of discounting here. And I think it's important to emphasize that in this paper that was written for the American Tax Policy Institute, the model is set up not to be a model of a particular state. It's set up to be a model of a model of an average state. And of course, no state's really average. No state would claim to be the average state. But it's a model just to show how these taxes work in general. And the model is not a model of Alaska. I've never actually made a model of Alaska before. And it could be done, but I've never actually done it. So one question that you want to be thinking here would be, well, do the results presented here actually pertain to Alaska? Now, I would claim that they do, after having made models like this of a number of other states, and they're just not very, the differences between them are not really very great. And so the general conclusions that you draw from this paper, I think you'll find would hold very largely or mostly in Alaska, although obviously the numbers are going to be somewhat different. So in the model, we look at four different scenarios. We look at what would happen in the average state if we set the severance tax rate equal to zero, just abolish it. That's what we call Model A, and this is on the fourth scenario slide. I forgot to mention that. Then we'll look at a situation where the severance tax rate is equal to 12%. That's Model B. Model C is where the severance tax rate is set equal to 25%. And then the Model D is that same 25% severance tax rate with a credit of 22% of drilling costs against severance tax liabilities. So those are the four situations that we may want to look at. And then if you go to the next slide, I believe, it shows a graph of oil production over time. Remember, the purpose of the model is to show how these taxes affect production and other variables over time, and so we run the model for 110 years, and so this is what this is the graph of production for each of the four scenarios up to go over the technical details of the model. If you go instead to figure two in the handout, and you have this also as a slide, that just graphs the relationship between the real price of oil from 1959 up to 2007 against two other variables, U.S. proved reserves, U.S. proved oil reserves in billions of barrels, and U.S. oil production from proved reserves in hundreds of millions of barrels. Now, you have to watch the units a little bit here because I had to, I was just trying to get these three time series on the same graph. And the thing to notice here is that there have been two
Dr. Gerking, we're getting a lot of static again. It was good for a while, but now we've gotten some static. Is there any change on your end? Or?
No, I'm not getting the static.
All right, maybe if you speak a little bit louder into the telephone, that would be helpful so that it can come across.
Are you with me on figure two now, sir?
Yeah, we are on the graph that has the real price of oil from 1959 to 2007. That's the graph that you're on?
Yes, that's the one, sir. We're on the figure two, and with figure two, it shows there have been two significant spikes or big increases in the price of oil over this time period, roughly 50 years, and occurred around 1980 and then again more recently around 2007. And what you can see from the graph is that that oil production just didn't respond to those spikes. Oil production just continued to decline slowly as reserves in the U.S. fell. Mm-hmm. And this is the same pattern we observed, not just the U.S., but we observe it in all of the states as well. Now, why would this graph have any importance for a study of the severance tax? Well, if you're looking at severance taxes, the severance tax is usually levied as a percentage of total revenue. So, basically, it's like taking a little bit away from the price of each barrel of oil that is produced by producers. And so, if you change the price of oil a little bit that the producers see, it just doesn't change the production of oil by very much. There's just some almost imperceptible changes in production that we observe, but there's no sharp response of production to a change in the price. And if there's no sharp response to a change in the price, there won't be a sharp response to a change in the severance tax either. So what does respond to a change in the price that producers see? That's drilling. And you can go over to figure four, which is in the handout, and see, and probably on the slide two. And you can see where price movements do, in fact, coincide with changes in put in the well drill. This figure on page 329 of this chapter, picture four.
Dr. Gerking, we're going to have to, you're really breaking up badly again. If we could, do we need to try one more time, Madam? Brief at ease. Oopsies. Dr. Gerking, are you on a landline or is there?
I'm on a landline.
Okay. We're having to here technically keep the volume control up at its highest level, so I think that's bringing in more static than would otherwise be.
I'll do my best. Let me know if I get too quiet.
Okay. We are back on record now. So if Dr. Gerking, if you could kind of backtrack again, beginning on figure 9.1, it has oil production on the y-axis and years on the x-axis.
I'll start there. So we reviewed a little bit about the four different tax scenarios that we look at in this paper that range from a no tax situation, a no severance tax situation, to a situation in Model D that has a 25% tax, but with a credit for against the severance tax for drilling expenses, and even if and so that that even a substantial tax increase from 0 to 25% just doesn't affect production by very much, and that's shown in Figure 9.1. The production, the lines representing production from all four of the scenarios considered in the model just are not very different, even though the differences in the severance tax would be quite substantial. And so why do we get that result? And again, rather than trying to go over the technical factors in the model that might produce that result, it might be easier to look at Figure 2, which is in the handout, and you have a slide. For this entire U.S. oil production has been insensitive to oil prices over the last 50 years. So U.S. oil production has not really responded to the spike in prices, oil prices that occurred in the early 1980s, and more recently toward the end of the first decade of the 2000s. That's just a plot of data, really. It's not output from the model. That's just a plot of data taken from API and the U.S. Department of Energy. Basically, what production in the U.S. has done is it simply followed reserves down. Proven reserves have been declining for a number of years and slowly declining, and production has simply followed that down. If you wanted to make an educated guess as to what production would be in a particular year, just take 9 or 10% of proven reserves, and you're going to come pretty close. You don't even need the price to make a prediction of production. So the point is what.
Yeah, Dr. Gerking is going back to Figure 9.1, and then that chart with the pricing. Does that indicate that there's an inelasticity of production relative to an increase or decrease in tax and an increase in production relative to the price of oil?
Yes. When you say the production is insensitive to tax changes, you mean the more technical way to say that is the elasticity of production with respect to tax changes is low, or it is an inelastic relationship.
Thank you, Dr. Gerking. Please.
That's been the history in the U.S. That's been the history in if it's the history in the U.S., it's got to be the history in the states, because all the states just make up the national total, and so this is the result a way to understand the results that's produced in the model. Now, it's important to know, I think, that the severance tax just changes the price that producers see. You could say, well, let's just take one barrel of oil and ask, well, what price do producers actually receive from its production? And let's say that's $100 a barrel, close to what it is today. And then you increase the severance tax, and they're just going to see a little less of that $100 than they did before. So how much does that affect production today? Well, it really doesn't affect it by very much at all. What it does affect, though, is drilling activity, and you can see that in Figure 4, where using U.S. data, we plot the relationship between drilling activity. Drilling activity really does respond a lot to the price, and it'll respond to changes in the severance tax. But then drilling today leads to production tomorrow and the tomorrow after that, and so the production that comes of, or the extra production that comes of the drilling that occurs in the current period, or this year, or over the next few years, that gets spread out a lot over the next period of time, maybe over the next 10 years, 20 years. Look how long the production from Prudhoe Bay has been spread out in Alaska. It's been spread out for some years now since
All right.
that was discovered in the late 60s. So,
Dr. Gerking, we have a question by Senator McGuire, so please hang on while she presents her question.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Dr. Gerking. Have you studied Alberta's tax system at all? You have mentioned a series of states, Utah, Texas, California, but have you looked at Alberta's tax situation at all?
I've looked at it. I wouldn't claim to be an expert on the system in Alberta. I think there are some substantial differences between Alberta and any of the other U.S. states.
Okay, and then just following up on that, and maybe it's something you could get back to the committee on as well if you chose to. I assume you're testifying voluntarily and out of the goodness of your heart today as a professor. But
I'm a public servant.
And so are we, and so thank you very much for your public service. The reason I asked the question is because Alberta is sort of our closest neighbor when we look at behavior, investment behavior in Arctic environments, investments, and so on. And one of the things that we've looked to was the experience that Alberta had in a similar high-priced oil environment. And that was the second part of my questioning was, what end you've done research in a high-priced oil environment. And I want to get to that in a second. But if you got a chance to look at Alberta and get back to us, I'd be curious with your theories on elasticity and inelasticity to look at what happened in Alberta when they changed their taxation model to capture what they called windfall profits as well. Roughly the same time as Alaska, a bit earlier, and then saw a dramatic decline in investment, actually dramatic. In fact, the companies that were investing simply shifted over to the next province of Saskatchewan, and the data's there. They did a competitive analysis that you can see a report and the data that's there. As a result, many of the politicians lost their seats in power, and a wholesale change to their system ensued once a new government took over. So I'd just be curious to see whether or not your theories hold up after having analyzed that circumstance. That's one. And two would be, how do your theories fluctuate in a high-priced oil environment? And I'm reminded of a time about 6 years ago when we were listening to other doctors and other very esteemed intellectuals like yourself tell us that never, ever in history had there been a time where oil and gas did not deviate from one another by a ratio of 6 to 1. And I can remember sitting in the room and as a lawmaker thinking, well, I don't have time to go out and ascertain that for myself, so I'm going to believe that to be true. And then sure enough, in the last 4 years with the discovery of shale gas, what we have seen is the deviations, you know, going up to 29 to 1 on any given day. And that has then changed everything for us here in the state of Alaska. And we're now looking at decoupling our oil and gas systems as a result. And I just bring that up to say that it's not a criticism of you or a potential criticism. It's just to say that even you as a intellectual as a doctor know that sometimes you rely on data based in a certain price environment, and that can change. So I guess the final question would be, you know, getting back to us in Alberta, but have you looked at a high-priced oil environment? So how does behavior change or not change when oil is $100 more per barrel?
Well, the short answer would be, I think what I would have to say would be more applicable when the price is very high.
Okay.
Comparatively high, like $100 a barrel or more.
Okay, and I guess just...
I think that would strengthen the case for what I'm saying. Now, with respect to Alberta, I would prefer not to embarrass myself by taking a try at explaining what their tax system is on the oil industry, because I would probably just make some mistakes. I could either find out a little bit more about that, or identify somebody in Alaska who might be able to contact you with that information.
Through the chair, that would be excellent. And I guess the reason I'm saying it is because, and I know you understand this, but when we move from PPT into this Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, this ACES model, it was unlike anything any of us had ever seen. And so we were looking around to see what other jurisdictions were doing. And frankly, the notion of progressivity came from and was suggested in part from Alberta's windfall profits tax, is what they called it. And so the idea was, wow, in this high-priced oil environment, which people are predicting will remain that way for a while, should Alaska, as you know, under our constitution, we are the owners of the subsurface rights. Should we share it in more of that the profits at the higher end? And so the idea was, yes, let's do it. But we applied this progressivity rate, and so we end up with this model that behaves slightly different. And I'm trying to get my arms around. I know other committee members are. I want to do what's fair. I want to do what's right. But it really does appear to be having a detrimental impact on production in the state, not exploration, but production. And I, you know, if I were to just rely on the three articles that I have here from you, I would say that's wholly impossible. And yet that seems to be what's happening.
Well, I might just interject here that production could be declining for reasons other than the tax.
Right. And I do think there's evidence of that.
Dr. Gerking, if you could, if I understand you said at high oil prices, it's more support.
Yeah.
You know, so if you could explain what you mean by that.
Sure. If you levy a fixed severance tax against the value of oil production when prices are rising, oil industry profits, revenues compared to costs here, are also rising, and so the severance tax then represents a lower percentage of industry profits than they would if prices were lower. So it's a little like saying the tax is more affordable to industry in a rising price environment.
Thank you.
I'm trying to use non-technical language here, but that might be a way to say it.
And Doctor, if you could, one of the questions that you posit at the beginning of this article is, the question is whether state taxes tilt the time path of energy production to the present or the future. And if you could comment on what that is and the policy implications of that.
Sure. Maybe it would be good to draw a contrast to the property tax on reserves that California levies. I'll talk about the situation in California first. In California, there is no severance tax. They levy a property tax on reserves, and if you levy such a tax, it's going to speed up production over time. The industry will want to get the oil out of the ground more quickly than they would otherwise, as they simply attempt to reduce the tax base, or reduce the base on which they have to pay the tax, you see. So the property tax on reserves is going to speed up production, and so we've been there's been an academic literature, at least, that's developed to ask the question, well, does a severance tax slow down production? Do you tend to slow it down so you produce less now and more later? And in the model that we developed, that does tend to happen, but the effect is very small. You do tend to tilt production to the future to a small extent. But I think the effect is small enough. I wouldn't think that it would be a major factor for policymakers such as you and others on your committee to get too worried about.
All right, thank you, Doctor. And if you know, as far as the overall or more broad policy implications, what are your thoughts on shifting production to the present as compared to the future?
Well, it's just a question of what a state might want to do with its with the oil production it can have. You're asking. It's hard for me to answer the question because it would require something of a value judgment to. You know, to say is present production more important than future production, or is it the other way around? I think you, if I were just to state what my own preferences would be, I would really want to make sure that as a steward of the state's resources, that we didn't end up eating our seed corn. And by that I mean we want to preserve those resources in the ground until it's the right time to remove them, and I certainly wouldn't want to see production speeded up at all. That's just me talking. That's how my own thinking would come out. It's a value judgment, and so we can, there's no way I can prove that would be the right path or Alaska or any other state to follow.
Dr. Gerking, if you could comment, Alaska has credits on its oil taxes, and you have a statement in your article that says a drilling expense credit may cost more than the incremental severance tax revenue obtained. And it continues, although such credits may be worthwhile concessions if a state's objective is to generate greater support for increasing the severance tax rate, end quote. What do you mean by that? And please explain.
Well, let's just put it in, I'll put it in plain English. If a state governed by the production situation described in the model presented applies or gives a credit for drilling expenses against severance tax liabilities in the way that we do it here, if anybody were to think that the credit would pay for itself in increased severance tax collections later, I think they're going to be disappointed. I think the drilling expense credit is just going to cut the long run tax revenues that you get, and that prediction is illustrated here in table 9.3 on page 325 of the paper. If we look at the row called discounted severance tax collections in business, in other words, what we do is we run the model out for 110 years. That's a long time. Of course, no model's going to capture reality out that far. But to have some examples to talk about here, the severance tax, the discounted severance tax collections would be in Model D lower than they are in Model C by approximately $12 billion in discounted revenue. They're lower, even that's one of the things we were interested in writing the paper, is to ask whether a state could increase it, the amount of money it would get in severance taxes by applying a trailing expense credit. That is, do you get enough tax revenue back to pay for the credit? The answer was no.
Senator French.
Thank you, Dr. Gerken. I want to ask you about some Alaska data, and just have you comment on it, or you can withhold comment if you decide that that's better and you want to wait.
I'll take a try, sir.
Sure. Under our old system of taxation, before we went to a profits-based model, we had a so-called taxation system known as ELF. And the way ELF worked for a lot of fields in Alaska, you got a declining production tax rate over time. And at the field I'm talking about, Kuparuk, second largest oil field in North America, 1996, the production tax rate was about 12%. The severance tax rate was 12%. And that declined steadily down to below 1% in 2006. So we had a 10-year period of real-time reductions in the production tax rate from 12% down to nearly zero. During that same time, the decline rate for that field ran about 7%. That is, oil production didn't go up. It went down at about 7%, which is consistent with the decline rate at Prudhoe Bay. Does that data suggest anything to you about the model that you've been describing to us?
I have to look at the data that you're talking about, sir, but it sounds to me like, without having had a chance to review it, that production is just following its natural decline down as reserves fall, and the decline in the tax rate really doesn't have anything to do with, or has little to do with, the production that you've seen.
I'll send you the charts so you can review them. If you find that your views change after having read them, I'm sure if you get the information of the chairman, he'll circulate it to the rest of us. But that's certainly an argument I've been making independently of your analysis. But I think it's hard to overlook that fairly obvious conclusion. Reservoirs decline over time, irrespective of the tax rate.
That's right. That's what I think I would be coming up with when looking at the charts that you mentioned. But if you want to send them to me, I'd be glad to look at them tomorrow and get back to Senator Pascal on that.
It's very kind of you. Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Gerken, is another way of responding to Senator French's question, is that consistent with Figure 9.1, the graph that you include in your slide presentation? Okay, thank you. There's also some question on the comparison of Alaska with other states. What are your general thoughts on comparing state to states? You know, what are their weaknesses of doing that?
With respect to what variables, sir? With respect to the tax rates or costs or?
Tax rates primarily.
It's hard to make a comparison of tax rates. You have to go, I've convinced myself that it's important to look at these effective tax rates that I mentioned earlier in the presentation, rather than looking at nominal tax rates. You've got to put, or I've felt the need to put tax collections on a common footing with other states when making the comparison. In other words, take the it's a simple calculation. You just take tax collections in a state and divide it by total value of production. And that's going to net out all of the differences in tax in the base on which the tax is levied in each state, and it's going to take out all the differences in almost innumerable credits and exemptions that states have granted to the oil industry to try to stimulate production.
What would your Sure. What would your concerns be if the focus was only on one component of a tax structure and trying to compare that with other states?
That could be highly misleading, sir.
And in what sense do you mean that?
Well, you have to look at the whole tax structure that a state imposes on the oil industry or any other particular industry if you're going to get a clear picture of the tax burden on them. You can't. I don't think you can really take out one particular feature of the tax code in, let's say, Alaska and compare it to another state that may or may not have that same feature, because whatever features you have in Alaska might be made up for by other features incorporated in the tax code in Wyoming or Utah or another producing city.
Doctor, we have a question by Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, my understanding is that there are a number of states in the lower 48, for instance, Texas, that assess a property tax based on the reserves of the oil that are in the ground. And have you, in your experience, does this cause an increase, or does this lead to an increase in production, particularly in times of rising oil and gas prices?
If you levy a tax on reserves in the ground, as Texas does, and California does too, California's tax rate is higher on reserves in the ground than Texas is. But if you levy a tax on reserves in the ground, you give producers an incentive to what you might call mine out from under the tax. What you want to do in order to maximize profits in that situation is to simply get rid of your tax base. And getting rid of the tax base means more production now than later.
Thank you.
All right, Dr. Gerking, where are we at in your presentation? Is there something that we kind of jumped around on in the last 20 minutes or so? Is there something that you would like to present at this time?
No, sir. I've pretty much wrapped up the presentation. If there's an additional question or two, I'd be happy to entertain them. I'm finished with the formal part of the presentation.
Right. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Good question. Take a try on.
Thank you. Have you done any research on looking at the differences between changing royalty rates versus changing severance tax rates?
There won't be any difference in the effect.
Okay. Thank you.
And is that true?
Royalties is like an increase in the severance tax.
And is that a result of you need to put all the components of the load on industry together and divide that by production to get a better analysis? Is that
to get a true? Yeah, I would agree with that. To get a true picture, you need to put all the pieces together.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Slightly different topic, Mr. Chair. We've heard some arguments that the increase in North Dakota, for instance, in their production was caused by their tax structure. Some people have said that. Some people have said it's more due to the advent of hydraulic fracturing. Do you have any opinion on that? Have you looked at that at all?
I think that production, that production changes that you see in a particular state I would say that the weight of evidence would be against those production changes being caused by a change in tax policy by the state. I think you can see differences in production brought about by changes in technology such as fracking that you give an example of. I think you can see changes in production brought about by a large discovery of new reserves such as Alaska experienced in the late 60s with Prudhoe Bay.
there...
Unless the reserves are there to support production, you won't see the production. And if the reserves are there, then production is simply going to track the... it's just going to track the proved reserves that that are in the ground.
Any other questions by the committee members? Seeing none, Dr. Gerking, would you like to make any summary statement, or what would you like to do to at this time?
Well, I don't think I need to make any summary statement, Senator Fennessan. I think you've given me plenty of opportunities to say what I think on the subject, and I hope that you get an opportunity to hear from others as well. I'm sure you will, but. I will try to find someone in Alberta who would be willing to contact you and tell you what they know about the situation there. I just don't think I'm not the right person to make those comments because I just don't know enough about the situation. Another sort of a person that you might want to visit with is someone that would be knowledgeable about the investment tax credit that was levied by the federal government back in the 80s. I think I'm going from memory here. Maybe it was the 90s. The investment tax credit at the federal level worked very much like the credit for drilling expenses against several tax liabilities that Alaska is doing now, and maybe some knowledge of the federal experience with the investment tax credit would be helpful to you.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking at I think it's a chapter of a book that you wrote. It's page 331, State Tax Policy and Oil Production, and you talked about it a little before, and it I'm just trying to grapple with it. You were talking about credits at this point, and how if you do have credits, it will result in somewhat more increase in drilling, but it doesn't result in additional production. And I'm having a hard time tracking that. How more drilling? If you do get more drilling, it seems intuitively you would get more production and more revenue.
You do get some more drilling, and I think you can see this in table 9.3. Which is on page 325 of the chapter that you mentioned. If I compare, are you with me, Senator?
Yes, I am.
Okay. If you compare Model C and Model D in table 9.3, remember, in those two models, the severance tax rate is the same, 25%, but in Model D, we give a 22% credit of drilling expenses against the severance tax liabilities, and when we see that when we give that credit, we do see more drilling. If I look at the second row in that table, that's the row labeled total footage drilled in billions of feet. We do see an increase between Model C and Model D. So there's the increase in drilling that you would anticipate. But then if I go down a couple of rows to discounted severance tax collection, I see a decline in severance tax collections because the severance tax collections will less than make up for the loss of revenue from granting the drilling expense credit. So the money that you give in the drilling expense credit is less than the additional severance tax, or is more than the additional severance tax revenue that you collect. Sorry, I said that wrong. So the drilling expense credit does not pay for itself. You do get more drilling, you do get a little more production, but the credit doesn't pay for itself.
Thank you.
Seeing
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Stevens has a question, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Gerking. I really appreciate your knowledge, your experience, and willingness to share it with us. I guess one of the things I enjoyed most are your sort of more folksy comments, like, for example, don't eat your seed corn. Could you comment on that a little bit? Why, how do you come to that conclusion, and maybe expand on that if you could, if you wouldn't mind?
Well, I'll take a try on that one. I'm going to pick on the state where I used to live, Wyoming, a little bit. What they do in Wyoming is something I argued against for years and never got anywhere. See, there's no state income tax in Wyoming, and property taxes on the property tax on oil production there is pretty high, but the property tax on houses and things that just regular people like us own, they're pretty low, and the sales tax is pretty middling. So what they do in Wyoming is to pay for public services provided to everyone through collections of severance taxes levied not only on oil but also on gas and on other minerals that are extracted there. There's substantial mining activity to go with the oil and gas. So, but what I've always thought is they're just paying for current public services with current with current revenue from oil production. Well, that oil production you can't put back in the ground. So there's your seed corn. And so they're just taking it out of the ground, selling it, using the tax revenue to provide public services. Eventually, Wyoming will not be an oil-producing state. Wyoming will be tapped out on oil production. It'll be tapped out on gas production. Where are they going to be then? And so wouldn't it be better in their case, and I've always thought it would be, to balance the severance tax collected against some other types of taxes that also would be levied on people there who actually consume the public services they get. I don't think that's an unreasonable view, given that people benefit from police protection, fire protection, public schools, and so forth. I think people need to pay for those things that they get. If they had to pay what it really costs, I don't think they'd want quite so much of it. And that's sort of where I was coming out in Wyoming. And then, I guess you like the folksy comments. I got in the paper once when I said what I really wanted was a bumper sticker that said "Real men pay taxes." So that sort of summarizes my view on that. But with respect to Alaska, I would make the same argument, but not as strongly. I would just say you want to make sure that you're not pulling the resources out of the ground any faster than you have to pay for the services that the legislature deems appropriate to provide. I think that you want to make those resources last, and you want them to benefit the current generation of people who live there, but you also want them to benefit all future generations of people who live there. And you just can't know who those people are or what they're going to be doing, but you want to make sure those resources are there for those people to exploit.
Thank you, Dr. Gurry.
Seeing no further questions, the February 1, 2012 Senate Resources is adjourned. Thank you, Dr. Gerking.
Thank you for the opportunity.